Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. A reassuring continuity prevails. Two guests, two segments. Lale Khalili will talk about the role of the military in U.S. industrial development, and Kyle Chan will talk about how and why China is overtaking the U.S. Most of us are aware of how deeply involved in funding U.S. technological development the Pentagon has been. The internet, computers, radar, just three prominent examples. Yes, the federal government has also heavily subsidized basic biomedical research as well. The drug companies take that research and turn it into profitable products with barely a thank you. Or at least that's the way it worked until Elon came through with his chainsaw. But the military has had a huge role. What is less known is how long a history this has. My first guest, Lale Khalili, has a review of a couple of books on military technology in the London Review of Books. The books are barely worth mentioning, but Lale brings a lot of her own expertise to the topic. Unusually for an academic, she's professor of Gulf Studies at the University of Exeter in England. She's had a wide variety of experience outside the ivory tower. Her undergraduate degree is in chemical engineering, and she worked for several years as a management consultant. She was on this show back in August 2020 to discuss her book Sinews of War and Trade, A History of the Role of Shipping in the Economic Development of the Arabian Peninsula. A minor correction. About 8 minutes into this interview, Lale says, in the United States, and then mentions the NHS. She meant the United Kingdom, and NHS is the British National Health Service. Lale Khalili. You open with a look at Palantir. Trump's now got them assembling all the disparate data the U.S. government has on Americans into a single master database. Who is Palantir, and how alarmed should we be by this?
So many years ago, when I was working on my second book about counterinsurgency, I went to lots of conferences where various kinds of folks talked about how they could serve the war on terror. And this was sometime towards the end of the 2000s, let's say 2007, 2008. And I can't remember which one of the big guys from Palantir was there. One of them, one of the three founders, was there. I don't remember anything except for that person sitting on a dais with a number of other folks that were in the intelligence defense of, it was like a foreign affairs kind of forum. And whoever it was from Palantir was sitting on the stage and was talking about how they were going to do data mining. This was at the time where data mining was still new. And so they were talking about they're going to dig into very, very large databases, connect all the information together, and provide that information to the various US intelligence agencies in order for them to do the kinds of things they do, which is to figure out where the quote-unquote terrorists are, figure out information about the people in Iraq, etc. And at the time, I remember having worked on software development about a decade before that, I remember sitting there and going, about 50% of this is bullshit. And about the other 50% is terrifying, intrusive information gathering. And some 15 years after that particular event, my opinion hasn't changed. About 50% of what Palantir does is complete and total bullshit, exaggerating what it is that they do, which is to essentially provide a kind of a interface between lots of different sources of information that have different kinds of languages, and then allow for people to sort of translate in between all of these different sources. It's nothing super fancy. And then 50% of it is their willingness to put this particular kind of ability or software to use in the most nefarious, horrendous possible ways. And that is exactly what they do. So one of the reasons that they were so successful about selling their product to various kinds of intelligence agencies is that they could, for example, take stuff written on mainframes, stuff written on Windows versions from the 1990s, stuff written on Oracle databases running Unix and SQL Server, with stuff that is sitting on an Excel spreadsheet spreadsheet on a Mac and make all of those speak to each other. And of course, we know that given the sort of long history of the various institutions the US has and the kind of a patchwork development of softwares they've got, this is exactly the kind of convoluted system that they're working with. And so if you can manage to make this convoluted system work for you and be able to draw information from lots of different places and put them in conversation with each other, essentially what you're doing is really good database design. And that's what they're doing. But they're, of course, making it sound a lot more, I don't know, marketable. I mean, I would really recommend your listeners to go to YouTube and look up the investor call, earnings call that they did most recently, where Alex Karp, who's now the CEO of Palantir, sat there and talked about how he is going to put Palantir to use in places that we don't know and we can't talk about. And then this could serve the United States and the West, and it could be used to kill people. I mean, those were basically the kinds of things he talked about. So as I said, 50% bullshit and 50% horrifying intent.
Some of the these databases were kept isolated by the U.S. government for reasons of protecting people's privacy.
Exactly.
And Trump, of course, wants to smash down those walls and like put it all together and know everything about the population.
Yep.
That's what the terrifying part of this is.
People talk about often where every accusation is a kind of a confession. Everything that these warmongers in the United States have been saying about China creating a social credit system is actually being now created by somebody like Palantir under the auspices of the United States. The fact of the matter is that a lot of that kind of establishing of connections between different bits of the government's data agencies was already going on a little bit. I mean, we know, for example, from the major leaks that Edward Snowden provided, that the NSA was doing some of that work. Now, whether with Palantir's help or with their own in-house developed software, where they were actually accessing a lot of data in lots of different settings and from lots of different sources. The problem now is, of course, that with the combination of DOGE, a know-nothing president with extraordinarily megalomaniac ambitions, and a bunch of coding fascists, you could potentially now not only go and look at, for example, what people talk about on their phones or in their emails, which was happening already under the NSA, and probably continues to happen with the aid of all sorts of softwares produced in both Silicon Valley and in Israel, but also accessing things like Medicare records, Social Security records, employment records, IRS records. And so this essentially provides a database that is, I think, is horrifically terrible for controlling folks, but it is also ripe for blackmail. When Saudi Arabia's Prince Al-Waleed first invested in Twitter long before Musk bought the company, one of the conditions was for them to place some engineers in Twitter. And of course, those engineers went into the Twitter's databases and found who some of the dissidents were that were posting in Twitter. I suspect that the kind of database that Trump has in mind is intended to do that sort of thing. It's intended to be a kind of a surveillance mechanism. And it's horrifying, but also, is it doable? This is vast amounts of information. Can it be made to talk to each other? I don't know.
Okay, well, so let's put this into some perspective. A lot of your review is about the long relation between the U.S. military, U.S. government generally, but specifically the U.S. military and the private sector. The history of military contracting goes back pretty much to the beginning of the United States, doesn't it?
Yep. Yeah, I think that's what's so fascinating about this, is that for very good reason, people are setting off all sorts of alarm bells about Palantir. But in fact, the history of development of technology, whether industrial technology, chemical technologies, or software technologies, digital technologies as it is right now, in the United States is inseparable from the military development. People may say, well, this is the case everywhere in the world, but that is absolutely not the case. In most of the rest of the world, a lot of the technologies that are developed by public monies, but often through sort of investments in, yes, okay, militaries get some of it, but really a lot of those investments come through either universities or through other kinds of research bodies, subsidies, for example, from governments to corporations in order to do those kinds of research, but not necessarily for militaristic reasons. So in the United States, a lot of NHS money or other kinds of government monies do go to research, and these come through kinds of consortia between the NHS, for example, and King's College London's medical school. In the US, it seems to me that the vast majority of the innovations that are happening, whether in laboratories attached to universities or in private labs attached to corporations, the funding for those seems to come through the Pentagon, which is completely and totally unsurprising, given that the Pentagon funding is whatever it is. It's the largest of all of the discretionary spending of the United States. And this has been the case from the very beginning. And so what we find, for example, is that DuPont was established, the very famous chemical company DuPont was established at the behest of Thomas Jefferson to create gunpowder in 1802. So a scant decade or so after the establishment of the United States of America. And this gunpowder contract developed into the making of other kinds of chemicals of use by the military, including the plutonium that was used to drop the second nuclear bomb on Nagasaki in 1945. As I said, DuPont goes back to 1802 or 1803. At the end of the 19th century, in 1890s, we have Dow Chemical being established, which also similarly serves to provide various kinds of metals that are needed, for example, manganese and magnesium, for the government's use in various kinds of killing machinery, whether they're plane holes or whatever, and then develops into making napalm and making the kinds of defoliants like Agent Orange that are used in wars in Vietnam. And so this is on the chemical side. Shipbuilding, steel, Carnegie metal, Bethlehem, Carnegie steel, Bethlehem steel, all of these companies which are ordinary, everyday, or we think of them as ordinary, everyday industrial companies, actually got to be as big as they are and as powerful as they are, and got to concentrate their power precisely because they served the United States, in the case of the steel companies, for shipbuilding for the U.S. Navy. So what we find is that starting a scant handful of years after the establishment of the United States, this kind of a circulation of monies from the Department, War Department then, and later Department of Defense, into corporations. And these innovations, some of which have leaked out, not leak in the sense of being given away by whistleblowers, but in the sense of seeping out as a kind of a side effect, and which are innovations that are incredibly necessary and we can't imagine living without them. For example, internet are actually secondary to the original purpose of the inventions, which was to serve the Pentagon. And one wonders what would have happened if all of that money, instead of going to the killing part of it, had just simply been invested in the public good that everybody could use. But of course, then the U.S. wouldn't be the empire that it is today.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of the modern technologies that we just take for granted, computers, jet engines, radar, all this stuff, byproducts of military contracting. But now these relationships are a boon to propagandists who say that all that Pentagon spending benefits us all. What do you say to that line of propaganda?
That argument is an argument that a lot of the companies themselves that are providing technologies are putting forward. And I have two sets of arguments about that. Number one, if you are actually using the Pentagon as a kind of a conduit for that kind of research, what you're doing is you are already having a customer defining, in this case, the Pentagon defining what kinds of investments should be made. Even talking in the incredibly banal and boring and cliched managerial speak of innovation and disruption, if a customer dictates what you should invent, it actually takes away the possibility of imagining what else you could do, which is why DARPA came about. DARPA was this kind of a crazy body within the Pentagon, which was going to imagine the unimaginable and then fund possible projects that weren't going to go anywhere in order to have this kind of an imaginary invention possibility or ethos. So that's the first issue. But the much more significant issue is that, of course, the vast amount of these investments that go into this kind of research are actually spent on developing killing technologies or surveillance technologies, which on balance, what they might produce on the side may be great, but on balance, they are actually incredibly destructive. Think about the amount of research that has gone into the production of the F-35. Think about the extraordinary investments made into, for example, setting up, creating the nuclear weapons technology that could have gone into other directions, nuclear medicine, for example, or even nuclear power, or finding ways to create nuclear power that is not as dangerous as it is in the ways in which that we see this. And so my real argument is, of course, that these major inventions that we're seeing shouldn't be side effects. They should be precisely the thing that we're concentrating on. And one particular example that I want to give as a counterpoint is that the extraordinary amount of investment, public monies that were spent on finding a vaccine within a space of a year or less for COVID, should give us pause about all this money being routed through military war systems rather than pure research areas. For example, the mRNA vaccine was already in the works, but wouldn't have gotten the funding without that sudden fear of a pandemic. What if it had received the funding much, much earlier? What if the mRNA vaccine was sitting there ready for us to use, you know?
It's funny. This is one of Trump's few positive achievements, and now he rejects them.
Yes, it is. I mean, it's not hilarious. It's terrible. It's absolutely horrifying. But yes, it is precisely it. And of course, it wasn't Trump that was doing, you know, that was putting that money out. It was everybody else in the first administration who were seeing this also happening in China and in Russia and in Europe. And there was a little bit of competition going on. But there was also worries about pure capitalist worries about return to productivity. And that's why the vaccine was seen as an important and significant sink for investments.
I'm speaking with Lale Khalili, professor of Gulf Studies at the University of Exeter. Now, we have something of a generational war in the defense contracting business. Now, yeah. The old legacy contractors like Lockheed Martin are scorned by the likes of Thiel and Musk and these newfangled high-tech guys. Talk a little bit about this generational war.
Yeah, so I think this is quite interesting because one of the things that these techno-libertarians, who now shade into techno-fascists in Silicon Valley, one of the things that...
It's funny how often that happens, isn't it?
Isn't it, though? One of the interesting things that they are very good at is to take the language of the left and adopt it to their techno-fascist bullshit. Some of them do that, some of them don't. Palantir's CARP and its chief technology officer, Shyam Sankar, are particularly good at doing this. One of the things that Shyam Sankar and Alex Karp both do is to talk about, the language of monopsony, how, for example, with Pentagon being the single customer, in some senses, for all of the big technologies, that what it has done is it has essentially forced all of, 50 or so different kinds of technology companies into becoming an oligopoly of five companies. This has slowed them down. It stumps innovation. So they talk about the kind of control of the monies, they talk about the dominance of the primes, and the generational change is one in, I actually think that a lot of this is performance. It's a lot of this is theater, because in fact, what the technology companies want to do is to get a bigger piece of the pie than they're already getting. So obviously, the big primes, Lockheed Martin, Boeing, Northrop Grumman, Raytheon, which now has some other kind of RTW or some weird little new moniker, and General Dynamics, what they do is they produce big machinery. It's to the benefit of these Silicon Valley companies to say that the next war is going to be not a war of the big machinery, but a software war, a cyber war, a swarm war, so that what you really need is a cheap-ass drone that you could buy off internet, But what you really need is a software that can control a drone swarm, which is what Andúril, another one of these quasi-fascist techno companies.
And another one named after Lord of the Rings. What is it with these guys in Lord of the Rings?
Well, as somebody pointed out, of course, that Scott Long has pointed this out. Of course that these guys named themselves after the Lord of the Rings, because the kind of a universe that initially was created in Lord of the Rings, in which the white elves rule the hierarchy of beings, and at the very bottom of it is the dark-skinned orcs, fits their white supremacist, incredibly fascistic vision of how the world should function. It's a combination of, on the one hand, old-school fascism, and on the other hand, schoolboy incel fantasies.
Yeah, these guys, you know, they have too much money and power, but they never grow up.
They never did. And which is why recently there was a profile of Curtis Yarvin out in The New Yorker, which I was reading. And the whole time that I was reading it, my mouth was hanging open in awe of how unbelievably juvenile he is. And somehow he's taken to be one of the philosopher kings of this movement of techno bros. But essentially, part of the reason that these techno bros feed into this, and Quinn Slobodian has talked about this, is because they imagine themselves as being super intelligent. The travesty of the bullshit idea of IQ really rules them. And so they consider themselves to be high IQ, and they have eugenicist ideas about breeding with other high IQ people so that they could produce high IQ children. And they, because they know software and they have created AIs that can summarize stuff for you, and they've created software that can unleash a drone swarm on migrants trying to cross the border or on the Chinese coming next to the US bases or whatever their paranoid fantasies are, they think that they should do it. They should be able to control all of these different kinds of technologies without any kind of oversight. And that's also part of the reason why they are bulldozing through so much of the bureaucracies. Much of the bureaucracy they're bulldozing through is actually that it produces essentially oversight into those bureaucracies, producing reports, producing red tape, being responsive to the Congress, whether or not Congress gives a shit. They want to get rid of all of that because they don't want any accountability and they don't want any oversight.
Much to their convenience, they found a political vehicle in the Trump administration. I mean, this is all over Trump's personal head, but it does seem that there is a community of political interest between this Silicon Valley formation and the people around Trump.
Yes, and I think one of the things that we can't forget is that it's not just the Silicon Valley founders, the sort of the engineers that make up the companies, but it's also the VCs, the venture capitalists, and perhaps one of the most venal and vicious ones among them is Andreessen Horowitz, which have these incredibly autocratic ideas about what technology should do. And they consider themselves, as Yevgeny Morozov has said, they consider themselves philosopher kings, and they consider any kind of opposition beneath them. And so it is unsurprising that they have found in Trump a vehicle, perhaps not one necessarily to their liking, but a vehicle or a conduit to power. If you remember, in Trump's first administration, he posted some kind of a tweet somewhere which made fun of Elon Musk about how Musk was actually coming to kiss his feet in order to get government contracts. It's fascinating to me that all Musk had to do was to donate $300 million to his campaign in order to come in and not just kiss his feet, but stand behind them and, you know, high on ketamine, and be invited in to do whatever the hell he wants to do.
But now they're feuding.
Now they're feuding, obviously, over the big, beautiful bill. But those massive egos would have clashed. But there are others within that orbit, including Andreessen Horowitz, including Thiel, including a number of others whose names we may not necessarily know, who are quite happy to talk to people just beneath Trump in order to get the kinds of ludicrously lucrative lucrative contracts that they're going to get. One of the things that was fascinating to me while I was writing this piece, and I had to actually excise it because I could have easily written a whole book about this, was that a lot of the creation of the Unit X, which is an equivalent of DARPA, let's say, for the digital age, happens around the time that the blood testing lady, remind me of her name.
Oh, Elizabeth Holmes.
Elizabeth Holmes was trying desperately to pitch her blood testing machine, the non-existent fantastical blood testing machine, to the Pentagon. And that was part of the reason why she had brought all these national security guys from Shultz and Kissinger to Mattis and others onto the board of her company, onto the so that she could actually have inroads into the Pentagon. And I think that a lot of these guys are also seeing these inroads into the Pentagon as an incredibly useful way of just making money hand over fist. Andreessen Horowitz on their website has actually an entire page dedicated on pitching to the Pentagon 101, which goes through and talks about the structure of the Pentagon, the procurement processes there, how to create shortcuts, what to do in order to be able to pitch, what sort of language to use. It's crazy. I mean, it's they're feeding essentially at the public trough, because if my taxpayer money is going, if all of my taxpayer money, and I am still a US citizen and I will probably have to pay taxes till I die, no matter how much I avoid the country, it's nevertheless, my taxpayer money goes into the US budget, which means that with this kind of an open conduit to the Silicon Valley, there is an upward redistribution of taxpayer funds into the pockets of these billionaires that run the Silicon Valley, whether they're VCs or founders.
Getting back to the Trump and Musk feud, one could imagine a spiteful Trump trying to cut off Musk's contracts. But on the other hand, Musk's operations like SpaceX and Starlink have become really integral to the Pentagon's operations, haven't they?
They have indeed. So one of the things that both Musk and Thiel have done is to sue the Pentagon.
That was a stunning thing. I hadn't heard that before.
Yeah.
They sued them for not using their services.
Exactly. So Musk did that successfully in 2014. Thiel did that successfully in 2015. And in the case of Musk, what I couldn't get in there, and which I think is really useful to know, is that he managed to sue. He won against the US Air Force, saying that his rockets should be the ones that launch satellites, even before those rockets had actually been tested to be functioning. It took some time for those rockets to be functional enough to be certified by the US Air Force. That is outrageous. In the case of Thiel, he essentially sued, I can't remember which subsidiary body of the Pentagon, to say that they should be using Palantir or Project Gotham, which is one of the products that Palantir sells, instead of developing an in-house product that allows for connectability or connectability or commensurability between different sides of the software. And this means that they essentially have now woven themselves integrally into the Pentagon, which makes it incredibly difficult to unravel them out of it. Having said that, this has been the case with almost all of these other technology companies that, you know, from the industrial age, as they would call it. Boeing wouldn't survive if it weren't, they do all those buybacks, but they wouldn't survive without providing airplanes or airplane parts to the United States Department of Defense. Lockheed Martin wouldn't survive. Northrop, all of these companies wouldn't survive. And in fact, while I was doing this, I was looking up lots of stuff from the 1960s, because obviously 1960s and 70s was another moment in which there was a lot of attention being paid to these major military industrial firms. And in the 1960s, this investment primer for ordinary folks that wanted to invest had a section on the airlines. And it had a line in there that said, basically, no airline in the United States would have been able to develop airplanes had it not been for the subsidies that essentially they got from the Department of Defense. So if you want, what this is essentially socialism for the military industrial complex and kind of a vulture capitalism for all the rest of us.
Aslale Khalili, professor of Gulf Studies at the University of Exeter. Her article, Collective Property, Private Control, is in the June 5th edition of the London Review of Books. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News, back after a musical break. That was some of Fingerprint File, an ancient ditty about surveillance paranoia from the Rolling Stones. Next, China and the American Imperium. The other day, Foreign Affairs, a publication of the Council on Foreign Relations, which was once a semi-official organ of the American Empire, published the Empire's obituary, The End of the Long American Century. The article focused primarily on Trump's destruction of American soft power, the cultural side of the Imperium, as opposed to hard power, guns and money. Of course, the American empire has been slipping for some time, but Trump, in his America First obsessions, is perversely accelerating the decline. Attacking our leading universities, savaging research budgets, restricting immigration, these institutions and practices have been part of the foundation of U.S. power since the end of World War II. It's no accident that the CIA, along with overthrowing governments Washington didn't like, also promoted abstract impressionism and subsidized magazines like Encounter and Partisan Review, they knew that while force is the ultimate guarantor of imperial power, for day-to-day domination you need hegemony, seemingly voluntary consent from the dominated, and universities and cultural production are crucial parts of that. That soft power does intersect with the harder side. Universities, for example, bring in foreign students who often stay here and become important parts of American economic life. For example, according to research by Axios, about 24 major U.S. startups were founded by foreign graduates of Harvard. None of them would have been permitted to enroll under Trump policies. My next guest, Kyle Chan, a researcher at Princeton who focuses on Chinese industrial policy, had an opinion piece in the New York Times a couple of weeks ago. It argued that the early months of President Trump's second term is the watershed moment when China pulled away and left the United States behind. The headline the Times put in this article, "In the future, China will be dominant, the U.S. will be irrelevant," is more pointed than an academic would have put it, but that's journalism for you. I'm certainly not interested in trying to preserve American imperial power, but what's so disturbing about all this is that these restrictive policies will make us an economically and culturally poorer country, dumber and more provincial. Here's Kyle Chan with more. To put it crudely, in the way journalists love, is the American century over and the Chinese century dawning?
The headline is making a bold claim. I think my argument is really about this moment that we're facing in history, that looking forward, rolling for the current trajectory, things are possibly more dire than we realize. And the destruction, in particular, of the Trump administration of the what I call the pillars of American power is could be lasting, could be far more profound than many of us might see today, even if we see today quite a bit of destruction. So this could really be an inflection point, I would argue.
Now, U.S. policy has been increasingly hostile to China since at least the Obama years, but Trump has amped it up, both in his first term, but now especially in his second. Have any of these restrictive policies, the restrictions on technology exports most prominently, have their desired effect, or have they just served as stimuli to Chinese technological development?
Their impact has been more mixed than was perhaps originally thought to be. So yes, in some ways, for example, export controls, not only on high-end semiconductors, but on the equipment required to make them, especially for really cutting-edge semiconductors, that has slowed down some aspects of China's progress when it comes to chips and AI. At the same time, though, there is probably no better way to motivate not just Beijing, but all these companies, all these Chinese companies reliant on high-end semiconductors, there's probably no single better driver of this push for self-reliance and resilience than this outside impact from the U.S. So I think that that sort of second-order effect could end up being even bigger.
And of course, now we have Trump hacking away at research funding and our leading universities. How does this approach contrast with China's?
So it's funny because China's doing the opposite in many ways. They're doubling down on industrial policy. They're ramping up spending on R&D, both public spending and private spending. They're really trying to elevate. I mean, universities, professors, scientists in China already are very high status. They're really pouring resources into boosting that sort of scientific foundation that we have historically done very well at. So I think right now we're seeing sort of a contrasting image in the two countries.
Specifically, what do they do? I mean, what is the nature of this industrial policy? How does China shape it?
Yeah, so at a high level, Beijing will pick out a few sectors, a few target industries that it wants to develop and maybe become a world leader in. So, you know, perhaps people might be familiar with the Made in China 2025 plan that was rolled out in 2015, where Beijing picked out industries like clean tech, electric vehicles, batteries, shipbuilding, high-speed rail, and really wanted China to become a world leader in a lot of these sectors. And then what happens is plans are made at the central level, but also at the local level to try to test out different policies, whether they are forming joint ventures, bringing in foreign companies to pick up technology and know-how, or it comes down to local governments helping to provide land and other resources, infrastructure for local companies. And then you have this sort of fierce competition across a range of local players. You see this, for example, in the electric vehicle space with the rise of BYD emerging from something like 100 plus EV makers in China. So all these factors combine together to produce, I think, these fairly strong positions in a number of industries today.
I think Americans have a hard time understanding the Chinese system, the relation of state and private capital. Could you talk about that a little? Because it's just not something that we're familiar with.
Yeah, it's a blend, actually, of a more state-directed approach, but also aspects of what we might be more familiar with in the United States. So you have a strong role in certain industries for state-owned enterprises. These are companies owned either by the central government or local governments that control things like mining, utilities, energy, you know, sort of the pillar industries. But you also have a lot of private companies that might get subsidies or other forms of support from, again, central and local governments. And the idea here is to combine some aspects of not a command economy with, you know, China tried that in the past with mixed success, but a sort of state-directed economy with competition that we are perhaps more used to in the American system. And the idea is, you know, you take ideally some of the benefits of both worlds and you get something that might be able to defy, say, short-term market pressures in support of these longer-term national goals.
It seems that Trump's use of tariffs without any supporting industrial policy is more likely to be self-defeating than promote real economic development.
That's right. So his goals, as he has laid them out, is to bring back American manufacturing, to bring back American manufacturing jobs. But the way that he's going about it in many ways is sort of the exact opposite of how you should do it if you were to use a more deliberate, carefully thought out strategy. You know, things like tariffs, things like cutting down bureaucratic red tape, they have an important role to play, I would argue, actually. These are tools that are part of a broader toolkit. The real question, though, is how you implement them in a way that doesn't end up backfiring and, say, raising costs and uncertainty for your domestic producers. Ideally, you want to bring back parts of the supply chain, targeted aspects over time. Maybe you want to have some industry protections for certain industries, say our clean tech industries in the United States, if you want to build up a robust battery supply chain here in the U.S. Those are worthy goals. The question is then, how do you sort of sequence things in a you know, well thought out and predictable manner so that industry can respond in a way that ultimately results in jobs and economic growth. I think what we're seeing right now with Trump's sort of blanket tariffs and then pulling them back on is probably the worst case scenario for American businesses, not to mention American workers.
Well, he's also targeting what we call yesterday's industries. It doesn't seem like bringing back aluminum production should be particularly a high priority, but that seems to be the kind of thing he's obsessed with.
Yes, and not only that, but I think he's thinking about sort of a historical version of American manufacturing that I think many American workers today might not be interested in going back to. I think people are interested in high-tech jobs, high-skilled jobs. They would like training. They would like resources to be able to go into those sectors. I think Trump is looking backwards rather than forwards.
Americans got lulled into complacency, one fueled by racist stereotypes, that Chinese would remain perpetual subcontractors with no technological skills or ambitions of their own. That really hasn't worked out very well, has it?
Yeah, I think a lot of people might still have an outdated view of what China does.
Vance said a month or two ago, we're borrowing money from peasants to buy products made by peasants. I mean, that's just... Does he know what China is like at all? Does he have the slightest clue what's going on in China?
Yeah, that quote really captures it, as does Trump's sort of constant harangue about dolls from China and how we, you know, Americans could go with less dolls. You know, there is still some of this consumer goods manufacturing that is still largely in China, but Chinese industries have moved up the value chain, have been trying to enter, and in many cases successfully entered into higher end goods and products like cars, medical equipment, pharmaceuticals, a whole range of industries that I think we might think of as being, American or German or Japanese high tech sectors. China's entering those and competing actually quite fiercely.
The interview I'm running alongside this on this show is about American military contracting and the large role it's played in the historical development of American manufacturing and technology, which makes me wonder how much of China's technological development efforts, economic development efforts, are directed towards military spending and weapons development.
So there is some of that specifically earmarked for defense. I do think that there is a sense more broadly in a lot of this industrial policy that China would like to develop broadly construed dual-use capabilities, manufacturing sectors, so-called hard-tech industries, physical production that could also overlap with military technology. And, you know, Americans familiar with, say, World War II history know of the unique role that, say, automakers played in shifting over, pivoting to defense production. I think China's thinking the same way, realizing that sort of this economic foundation is crucial for military strength.
It seems that Trump and the people around him are operating with an inflated and obsolete notion of American power. I mean, he's always saying, you know, we have the upper hand, they have a weak hand. Is that true?
So there are a lot of weaknesses, it turns out. For example, right now we're discovering, or a lot of the countries discovering, that we have a very strong vulnerability in rare earths and rare earth magnets, where China has really come to dominate production.
Is that the result of just geological endowments, or is that a result of human capital, as I might say?
Yeah, that was part of a deliberate strategy on China's part to invest in R&Ds. And actually, some of this technology was originally discovered in the United States, but China made a very sort of national effort to build on that technology, to develop the techniques for developing permanent magnets, for example, which now go into, among other industries, the electric vehicle industry, as well as obviously a lot of defense equipment. So this was actually something where China sort of defied the markets, in a sense, tried to do something, invest in something that it found to be strategically important. And now the U.S., I think we're paying the price for not doing the same on our end.
Trump gets annoyed, like the Chinese are holding back on us, but, you know, why should they do us any favors?
Yeah, that's right. And the funny thing is, he often kind of portrays his actions as doing some kind of favor for China. So on the one hand, he has this sort of tough talk, this tough language in negotiating with China. On the other hand, he tries to say that he's throwing China a bone. The reality is China will do probably what it believes to be in its national interest. And I think China is proving to be a pretty tough negotiator in this process.
What do you think they make of Trump and the circus around him?
I think there is actually, even though, you know, we've sort of been through Trump 1 before, I think there's a degree of surprise and shock in Beijing by the incoherence and willingness to actually, you know, for lack of a better word, capitulate on certain areas that Trump had been talking so tough on during the campaign. So it was quite a shocking reversal, for example, those sky-high tariffs, as you recall, between the U.S. and China, this sort of tit-for-tat retaliation. And then suddenly, you know, there's a breakthrough in Geneva, and a breakthrough is easy to achieve when you simply agree to everything that the other party wants. And I think that was surprising to Beijing, as I think it was to many other people.
It's a mainstay of Western discourse that China is about to hit a wall, that longstanding problems with the Chinese economic model will sooner or later cause the bubble to burst. I'm mixing my metaphors, hitting walls and bursting bubbles. But what do you think of that line of impending doom?
So there are certainly serious problems that China is facing. There are serious challenges ranging from a growing debt overhang to a real estate bubble that has popped and is really dragging down the economy, as well as longer-term demographic issues and a shrinking workforce. These are serious problems. These are problems that China, I think, has recognized for a while and been struggling to try to deal with. I mean, these are very difficult ones. They also mirror problems demography, say, across East Asia more broadly as well. At the same time, though, what's interesting is China is still trying to push forward on technology and science and innovation. And I think their bet is that even with a slowing economy, no longer double-digit growth rates as they had in the past, that if there is going to be a path forward, it is through sort of high-tech industries and high-tech manufacturing, everything from AI, robotics, as well as even more traditional industries that have gotten sort of a high-tech refurbish.
Whenever our economy runs into trouble, people advocate tightening belts. That doesn't seem to be the Chinese approach.
No. I mean, there are some aspects of fiscal tightening, of trying to save on government spending, for example. But I think Beijing is making an investment, a bet in the long term, thinking that if we tighten too much, if we pull back too much, that will have long-term downstream consequences. So it's an investment, I think, in the future, a bet that these large-scale investments, even the debt that's going into some of these industries, will pay off in the long run.
Yeah, it's funny. Musk laughed at BYD when it first came on the scene, but now he's really not laughing so much anymore.
Yeah, that is probably one of the most incredible turnaround stories, right? Yeah, it wasn't so long ago when BYD, and in fact, in China, BYD was sort of thought of as a cheaper, low-quality player in the space. There was a reverence for, say, Japanese cars or German cars, for example. And now times have really changed, right? BYD is larger than Tesla by global revenue, topping over $100 billion a year. BYD recently overtook Tesla in the European market. So this industry that had been synonymous almost with Tesla for so long is now becoming more BYD's sort of space, and Tesla has been retreating. It doesn't help, obviously, for Tesla that Elon Musk is dealing with the blowback from his Doge efforts.
Yes, he's going to have some repair work there. But the BYD, it just happened so quickly. It was practically overnight.
Yes, it can seem like that from the outside. Certainly,
yeah, of course,
in the
yeah.
years since COVID, I think BYD has really kind of exploded onto the world stage, now building manufacturing plants from Brazil, Indonesia, Hungary, Turkey, all over the world. But I think this is actually sort of the tip of the iceberg, the culmination of a longer process of investment in electric vehicles and battery technology that goes back to at least the early 2000s, if not earlier.
Oh, yeah. And finally, you paint a very gloomy picture of the American future, although it's a persuasive one. Sheltered behind tariff walls, its companies will sell almost exclusively to domestic consumers. American consumers will be stuck with U.S.-made goods that are of middling quality and more expensive. Working families will face rising inflation and stagnant incomes. As I said, that's persuasive, though grim. But is there a way to avoid this fate?
Yes, there is. And we know what to do. We know where we're strong. We know what makes the United States a leader in many high-tech sectors. We need to continue to invest in science and education, and we need to stop attacking our universities and stop scaring away foreign talent. You know, one line that actually got cut from that New York Times op-ed is we take for granted that the next Google or Nvidia will be made in America. You know, we take for granted that entrepreneurs from around the world will want to set up business here. And I think we know what it takes to make this country a friendlier place, a more inviting place for people from all over the world to want to come and do business here. So I think we know what to do. We just need to do it.
Well, we're pretty much doing the opposite. It
seems. That's right. Unfortunately, that's right at this point.
That was Kyle Chan, a postdoctoral researcher at Princeton and author of an article in the New York Times on how Trump policies are exactly the wrong way to deal with China. He has a Substack called High Capacity, which you can find at high-capacity.com. We spoke some about BYD, the Chinese electric car maker. Next week, the economic sociologist Paolo Gerbaudo will explore the BYD case in detail. We also spoke about the backward-looking nature of Trump's tariff policy, his fantasy of bringing smokestacks back to the heartland, bracketing the facts that factory work could be body and spirit-breaking, and the reason that the jobs were once high-paying was unions and nothing unique to manufacturing, what might it take to realize this agenda? Recently, a trio of economists at Wells Fargo took the measure of the challenges involved. They're massive. A major obstacle, the huge amount of physical investment it would require. By their estimate, to return manufacturing employment to its historic peak of 1979, almost 20 million jobs, would take at minimum $3 trillion of additional investment. Though that would be spread out over several years, that sum still amounts to 70% of the current level of non-residential investment and half the manufacturing sector's current capital stock. Complicating that investment task is the policy uncertainty around tariffs and other economic policies, not the kind of environment that would encourage firms to dig deep. A new administration could easily reverse the tariffs, and then a lot of that investment would look like a waste. And even if corporate America came up with that huge sum, they'd still be facing substantial headwinds. One is high U.S. labor costs, 16 times as high as Vietnam's, 11 times as high as Mexico's. Add to that a shortage of workers with factory skills, which would take a lot of time to reverse, even if the population weren't aging. Factory workers are now 4 or 5 years older than average, and the sector isn't exactly luring the young. That shortage of workers is likely to be aggravated by the expulsion of existing immigrants and the barriers to new ones arriving. And since the tariffs are raising input costs for many industries, investment dollars will be shorter than they otherwise would be. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, some of color television, new from Stereolab. Till next week, bye.
Trees and grass, given way over the middle class. A promise to outplay the mass, for all the wealth can be a map. It's a single story, violently erased.